And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, boo! Not really. But we really are talking about Halloween, the holiday when little kids dress up and adults buy candy and pretend it's for kids. We'll talk about the spookiest of holidays, and we'll try to get to the bottom of the age-old question, does Halloween still matter? Then we'll take on a very big, very daunting topic, good taste. What is it? Do you need it? And how do you get it? And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Once again this week, Trey Graham is on vacation, so we are being joined by Tanya Ballard-Brown. Tanya Ballard-Brown, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor for NPR.org.
So by the time you are hearing this podcast, it will be bumping up against Halloween season.
Wow.
Now, I personally do not have little children who will be running around trick-or-treating.
I do.
But you do, Stephen. So talk to me a little bit about Halloween, your status as a Halloween dad.
Well, you know, my children are 8 and 11, and my 11-year-old, while trick-or-treating last year, declared that he was too old for trick-or-treating.
While dressed as a banana.
While dressed as a gigantic banana. And as I tweeted at the time, my son is the only child on Earth who can carry off a gigantic banana suit with the tragic melancholy of Charlie Brown on the anniversary of September 11th. All it needed was dun-dun-dun-dun-dun as his head sort of slumped down and he's...
His stem.
Did he get a bunch of rocks in his bag or something?
Saddest banana suit. So he wants to stay at the house and pass out candy. I think mostly to guard it. because we left out a big bucket of candy because it's me and the kids. You know, I take the kids trick-or-treating. There's nobody to hand out candy. So there's a big bucket of candy and it got raided by impudent little twerps.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he wants to guard the candy. So I will be taking my daughter out and dressing as beleaguered dad who eats candy.
Right. Well, Jonah stays
at
home.
What is her costume? Or is it a surprise?
Well, we just ordered her costume last night. It will be some sort of vampire derivative.
Gotcha. I really am disappointed that she's not repeating my favorite costume, which was her ninja costume, which, frankly, she still wears, around the house. She'll just come down the stairs, and she's dressed like a ninja, which is kind of great. If you knew Grace, you'd know, in particular, with her, having her just, randomly appear dressed as a ninja kind of gives you this terrifying glimpse of the future.
Well, or the present. She's stealthy and lethal. But last year, I had this issue. I took her to a costume shop, and basically there were two non-sexy options for 8-year-old girls. Because we'll get into this a little bit, but Halloween has sort of become this, Mardi Gras for jackasses everywhere. And one way that sort of manifests itself is that every Halloween costume for any female of any age is sexy blank. And this is true also of 8-year-old girls. So her options, as far as dad was concerned, were ninja or angel of death. And I was outvoted, and she went as a ninja.
Well, you know, Tanya, I saw from you recently, perhaps it was on Facebook, an internal struggle that maybe you'd be willing to disclose about a certain someone who you could not bring yourself to put into a Halloween costume.
I love my puppy, Alex. I do. He has two coats.
I was going to say, he wears clothes.
He has a raincoat. Those are functional.
Yeah.
Okay? I cannot put a costume on this dog.
Neither of those coats is his coat of fur. Actual garments you've acquired from this animal.
I bought him a coat because when I first got him, he was a rescue. He was all matted and had to shave his hair down.
Sure.
And the groomer said, until his hair grows back, to put a coat on him.
Sure.
My mother liked that coat, so she bought him another coat that was better than the coat I bought him. So he has two coats. Then, one day when I was slightly overserved and I picked him up from the doggy daycare, I saw this adorable little raincoat and thought how great that would be so that when he comes in from rainy day walks, he won't roll all over my furniture.
That's true. Okay. There's logic there.
So,
I have the same mentality with my children.
But you don't buy him a Halloween costume.
No, you know, I didn't have him last year. I got him in November last year, and it was right after. And I cannot say that I had not planned in my mind to have a costume for him this year. Yeah.
This is where we promise to throw up on the blog. Not throw up on the blog, but to put up on the blog Linda's favorite photo of all time, which is the dogs dressed as fast food.
Well, the thing is, they're dogs dressed as people dressed as fast food. That's what makes it funny. They're dogs dressed
That's what makes it funny.
Yes, it is. All right, so we were going to start by getting into a little Halloween pop culture. Glenn Weldon, do you have a piece of Halloween-themed pop culture for us?
I got a couple. Lock and Key is a really good horror comic, and it's L-O-C-K-E mm-hmm. and Key. It's by Joe Hill and with art by Gabriel Rodriguez. It's about a family with three kids. Dad gets murdered, so they pick up and move across the country to start a new life in the sleepy New England hamlet of Lovecraft, which, right there. This is the thing, in horror, people do stupid things.
You should have known you were in trouble. Yeah.
Like move to the town of Lovecraft. Where they move into, what else? A spooky old house. That has many doors and different keys, and if you open a door with a specific key, crazy crap happens. I'm going to just leave it at that.
Yeah.
It sounds gimmicky because the name is Lock and Key, and it's about, but it's really, really well done. It's really smart, and actually the art is amazing, and it's there's only been two or three storylines so far, so you can really pick up on it. It's great. The other thing that I think is perfect for Halloween night is the 1964 film Mask of the Red Death with Vincent Price. It's a Roger Corman film. It's based on, of course, on the Edgar Allan Poe short story. It is cheesy as all get out, but it's gorgeous. It's really kind of luridly colored. And it's Vincent Price at his Vincent Priciest. Attempting to seduce a buxom young maiden, which let's just leave that alone. but also briefly, there's three Bugs Bunny shorts that are perfect for Halloween evening, because if you're a kid like me, you're a fearful, nerdy, indoorsy kid who's scared of everything. And if you watch like the Munsters or Addams Family, yes, the things that scare you are made ridiculous, but you don't feel any agency there, just them being themselves. What happens when you watch Bugs Bunny enter a situation and proceed to diffuse all the horror by making fun of things is you feel like, oh, I can defeat the things that scare me with wit, with humor, by being smarter than them. And basically, it's the power of smart assery is a thing. It's a very important thing for kids to learn. So three of these films, 1956's Broomstick Bunny, where he meets Witch Hazel. 1963's Transylvania 65,000, where he meets Count Blood Count. And finally, 1950's Water, Water, Every Hair, which has the giant red monster with the nails and the my stars, that whole thing. that is, that's also great. So all these things give kids a sense of safety and power.
Nice. And that's good for Halloween.
I think so.
Tanya Mallard Brown, are you like a Halloween horror movie watcher? Do you like a scary monster movie?
I love scary movies.
Yeah.
I wasn't the kid who was scared by all the, like, in fact, I can remember being mad about some movies that were supposed to be really scary that turned out not to be scary to me. Like, what's the movie with the man in the fire?
The Shining.
The Shining did scare me because I was years old and my parents took me to see this movie that was too old for me. And
you were like
there was
two.
A dad in it who was acting crazy. And so after that, I remember like being real side-eyed to my daddy. Like,
So what kinds of scary movies did you think were scary when you were a kid? What kinds of movies
did you find
scary?
The Omen. Things that could sort of almost be
like creepy children. Real, that could happen.
Well, they use real Bible scriptures and stuff.
I see.
And then they're using song Christ.
Yep.
Antichrist. And then they're like, and then the Lord came down, and I'm like, whoo.
So they used your childhood against you.
Yeah.
Movies.
Yes.
Do you think it's creepy children in particular? Do you have trouble with other creepy children movies like The Exorcist and stuff like that?
See, that one didn't scare me.
Have you ever seen the Twilight Zone, any of the Twilight Zones with the creepy kids in them?
Yeah, like the one wishes them the TV and it puts the TV.
Well, and the kid who wishes them all out into the
cornfield.
Yeah.
That didn't scare me either.
So what
I was a tough kid.
So what did you like? Yeah, what like scared the heck out of you?
Devil Dog.
Omen?
You know, I'm telling you. The Bible stuff.
I was going to say, the hostess snack treat.
That's actually very profound,
though. If they
pulled
out the Bible, if there was any sort of scripture.
That's very profound, though.
So I remember Devil Dog was scary to me, and the Don't Go to Sleep guy, that wasn't scary to me.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
but it should have been scary to me. And I remember being mad that it was not scary to me.
So you were mad at Nightmare on Elm Street for not being scary.
Yeah, to me.
You're the one.
Because it's very interesting because I think what you're identifying is that, like, there's a difference between traditional horror slasher stuff and the stuff that really gets at something in you. Because one of the things I was thinking about is, I don't know if anybody else here has seen the Ryan Reynolds movie Buried. Mm-hmm. But in the Ryan Reynolds movie Buried, the gimmick is he wakes up, he's been a contractor in Iraq, I believe, and he wakes up and he is in a coffin, buried. And he has a cell phone and a lighter, and he has to call for help and try to figure out. And the whole movie takes place inside his trapped. That movie, absolutely. I do not even like to really think about that movie. It unsettled me so much.
I don't like to hear you describe it.
That was the kind of movie where I will not want to go to sleep right after I see it. I will need to go do something else. And this is an occasion for me to tell one of my absolute favorite stories from law school, which is that one of the guys I went to law school with, there was a story that was going around about him that after he saw the Blair Witch Project, he lived in this house kind of in the woods. This was in Oregon. And that after he saw the Blair Witch Project, he had to put towels over the windows and watch A Bug's Life.
Just to bring himself down from the fear.
Reportedly watched A Bug's Life twice before he could go to sleep. I love that story more than anything.
See, what I did with the movie Buried is I read the Wikipedia description. Okay. Takes some of the power out of it. Just diffuses it.
It's true.
So I know about it, but I didn't have to sit through it. Did the same thing for that film, Sinister. Nope, not going to see it. Never going to see it, but now I know what happens.
You're aware of its work.
I am.
Well, Stephen, how about you in Halloween pop culture?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily have a lot of great examples of movies that scared me as a kid, other than Jaws, which I think I've discussed on the show, where my parents took me to Universal Studios tour and a shark almost ate me.
Mm-hmm. I do remember that. You have told that story.
But that's a different thing. And so,
an animatronic shark almost ate me.
Killer animatronic sharks were a real fear of mine as a child. Halloween itself, I mean, does it seem to you like Halloween has gotten a little bit less scary, like a little bit less perilous? It feels like when we were kids, there was always this thing about how, like, you had to X-ray all your candy.
Well, that's the thing. Like, for a time, there was more, like, actual peril associated with Halloween. Like, people would really consider trick-or-treating to be an unsafe thing.
Right.
You know, we grew up in kind of a certain wave of, like, all the stranger danger.
Yeah.
Like, don't let your kids go out by themselves. But also the candy tampering stuff and the you know, razor blades and apples.
Well,
like, any kid who gets Halloween apples has ever actually eaten one.
For all we know, there have been thousands and thousands of razor blades left in apples.
Adulterated raisins.
Would you see this? Wouldn't the apple be brown and bruised there?
Well, I would think so.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, there was all this stuff.
Tainted handfuls of pennies.
When we were kids, there was all this stuff, though, about, like, you shouldn't let your kids eat anything comes from anybody you wouldn't know. And one of the funny things is, when I was growing up, trick-or-treating was very different for me than it was for other people, because I lived in a place that was remote enough.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't live in, like, a development or, like, on a regular residential street. Where I grew up was remote enough that when we went trick-or-treating, my dad would drive me from house to house because it was too far to walk. And so, to me, I never understood, like, the sense that people had of, like, my friends and I went out trick-or-treating by ourselves and it was this great night, because to me it was going out with your parents and they would drive you from house to house and it was fun.
Well, it's awkward to toilet paper people's trees when your dad's waiting in the car.
That's true. So, yes, I agree with you. Less scary.
Less scary. And it's not just because we're older. It's because it's actually less scary.
I would think so. Jonah seems mostly depressed.
Well, but I wonder, too, if some of that is because there's more television and sort of advances you have, and that they can play all these games and all these things that we just didn't have. So we were scared of the boogeyman. And then, of course, you know, Boo came around. Boo! And Monsters, Inc.
Well, yeah. And I think Monsters, Inc. is a great example. And you raise a great point, which is, I feel like most children's entertainment revolving around Halloween these days has been about demystifying monsters.
Right.
The monster presented as the good guy. I mean, I mentioned a few weeks ago seeing Hotel Transylvania, in which the monsters are presented as good guys.
Mm-hmm.
Monsters, Inc., the monsters are presented as good guys. Despicable Me is, you know, the supervillain is presented as a good guy. And I think, in general, there's a desire to...
Wicked. It's true.
That,
if Trey were here, he'd back me up.
No, totally. That people are so... I feel like makers of children's entertainment now are so interested in not filling kids with unreasonable fears that these things are sort of coming pre-demystified.
Yeah.
The example of Halloween culture that I wanted to bring up, and I might have mentioned this on a we've now had like three Halloween episodes This is crazy. The show's been around so long now. The one that I wanted to bring up is the Halloween episodes of Roseanne.
We definitely touched on this, but I don't think we used it as a big...
We might have touched on it briefly, but I think it's really interesting when you go back and look at that show. First of all, really, really great show. Okay. And I feel like a somewhat underappreciated show today. Uh-huh. And when people look back on great, you know, on all-time great TV shows. Uh-huh. But particularly the Halloween episodes of that show. For those who don't know the Roseanne show, you know, it's Roseanne Barr and John Goodman and their kids. And they're genuinely working class. And they make a point of this on the show, that the other holidays just don't mean as much to them. Uh-huh. That their big family bonding holiday is Halloween, in part because the other holidays have all these costs attached to them.
Yeah.
And the fact that they can use their hands and use their minds and use their imaginations.
Well, it's not a gift-giving holiday.
It's not
so
a gift.
So you don't have as much.
Wait, I think candy is a great gift.
That's true.
We agree.
No, absolutely. But there was all this energy that they would pour into Halloween. And I sort of felt like that was the, that was kind of the ideal view of Halloween, even though I've never taken that view myself and tend to really brush past Halloween.
I'm trying to remember who it was because now it's driving me crazy, but somebody said on Twitter, someone I follow, just in the last week or two, that if Roseanne had been smart enough to brand their Halloween episodes the way that The Simpsons branded the Treehouse of Horror stuff,
that's a great point,
that they'd be as well regarded, if not more so, than the Treehouse of Horror episodes.
Can I make a controversial assertion here, which is that, see, this is my favorite time of year. That's not the assertion. this is cider and donuts. There's a Christmas in the air. There's leaves.
That's wonderful.
You can go out to the wineries in Virginia. You can go to a corn maze. I love a corn maze. Yes.
Yeah.
I got layers. I love a corn maze. It's like you're in the middle of this purple-prosed Ray Bradbury short story for like a month.
Yeah.
There is, to the accoutrements of Halloween, a sort of cheapness nowadays.
Yeah.
There is something that, like, okay, so the spider web you're putting on your porch doesn't look like a spider web. It looks like you just unraveled a sweater. Like, you really hate sweaters.
Yeah.
And the little tombstone and everything. And can we just talk about candy corn, which is to Halloween what the black jelly bean is to Easter?
It's pretty bad.
No,
yeah.
I'm a candy corn guy.
Oh my gosh.
Look, here's what candy is. Some kind of chocolate is involved. Some kind of peanut butter is involved. Some kind of caramel is involved. Or there's a fruit flavor. Mm-hmm. But this is other. This fills that sort of...
circus peanuts.
It's wax.
This is in the wax and circus peanut family.
You can't rationalize this. This is just congealed corn syrup.
Yeah, that's fine. There's enough corn syrup congealing on my insides.
Right.
No, I agree with you.
What's the most hateful thing about a Halloween party? A, if your costume is really clever, how much time you have to spend explaining it to people.
Mm.
B, couples costumes. We agree, right? There's a certain aggression in a couple's costume. We're not just together. We are thematically together.
Well, and someone made the other one put that on.
Yes, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Someone was like, well,
we'll
I'm
be
gonna
a Rubik's Cube.
Right.
Yeah.
You'll be the butt of the donkey.
Well, I may be, you know, just reacting to this because of a traumatic experience in my past. When I was a 10-year-old toe-headed youth, my parents went as Reddy and Betty Kilowatt. Do you guys know who Reddy Kilowatt was?
Oh, it sounds vaguely familiar.
He was the mascot of the electric utility industry for many years. So my dad was Reddy Kilowatt.
Your parents really got down.
Yes. My dad was Reddy Kilowatt in a black bodysuit with a giant electrical plug around his midsection.
Oh,
my mom was
this.
An outlet.
I've seen this.
And when they got together, a light bulb my dad was holding lit up.
Wow.
So this is good. This is important for a 10-year-old boy.
Pretty Pastor Weldon.
I learned what it meant to be mortified that day.
God,
at first,
I bet. What,
it's like, I can't show you the data, but it's pretty sure it's what made me gay. Pretty sure. It's like, I'm 10 years old.
So
I don't
you
know
made
what's
a choice that day.
Exactly. I don't know what's going on here with this, but I'm pretty sure I want no part of it.
Like, I'm literally standing here with my hands over my face.
Can you imagine?
It's so bad.
It's gross.
It's so bad. And I mean, I say that as someone who was once with their parents when they busted other people for being in a snowball fight because my parents worked at my school, and I still think that would be worse.
Yeah, that's awesome.
All right, well, when I started looking for a piece of Halloween pop culture, I was a little bit flummoxed, and then I remembered something that I thought, well, I haven't heard this in probably at least 35 years, so I can't imagine that I'm going to find it on the internet. But there it was.
Yeah, the internet takes
it's
your
on
challenge.
Spotify. It's on Amazon. You can get it. It is an album called Monster Rally by Hans Conried.
Oh, nice.
With Alice Pierce, who is this comedian who, to refer back to something that we talked about on the show not long ago, plays the nasally congested roommate in On the Town. She is Betty Garrett's roommate in On the Town. And she was a very accomplished character actress, comic actress. And she is essentially the woman partner to Hans Conried in all these songs themed around Halloween. Now, some of them you would know, Purple People Eater and some other ones, but there are all these songs on this record. I used to listen to this. My dad had this LP, and I listened to it. This is not like a teenage years thing. This is like a 7 or 8 years old, I'm guessing. And I have not listened to it since. So when I found it today and started listening to it, it's one of those things where you realize words to songs, at least snippets, have sat in your brain for over 30 years.
Right, yeah.
And it's kind of shocking.
But and imagine all the stuff since then that you've forgotten.
Absolutely. I don't even want to start to think about it. But for example, I'm in love with the creature from the Black Lagoon.
I'm in love with the creature from the Black Lagoon. Though fate now keeps us countless miles apart, I was stuck to this creature like an old harpoon. But he fled, leaving me a broken heart.
A very fine song. And a song called Close the Door, and it's about monster attack.
Close the door! They're coming in the window. Close the door! They're running up the stairs. Close the door! They're hanging on the ceiling. Those are everywhere.
And interestingly enough, there's both I'm in love with the creature from the Black Lagoon and The Invisible Man, which is about being in love with the invisible man. And how strange it is, for example, when you go out to dinner and people think that you're there by yourself.
My friends feel sorry for me. They call me on the phone. They wonder why they always see me dining out alone. I find it very difficult to make them understand that I've been going steady with the invisible man.
This is obviously a novelty record, very much in the kind of Dr. Demento sort of tradition. And I honestly had no idea it was still out there. But
it's almost always still out there.
Yeah.
But it is still out there. And like I said, I remember what the record looked like. It was a purple record, and it had pictures of Hans Conried and Alice Pierce on the back. And I would sit in the house, and this is how I developed my sense of humor, is listening to things like, I'm in love with the creature from the Black Lagoon.
And so you still are.
That's what's wrong with me.
There's nothing wrong.
Well, plus I still have approximately the same taste in men. Hi-yo!
Hey!
But, so that was what I came up with, because honestly, like Stephen, I don't fixate on thoughts of Halloween being terribly scary. Like Glenn, my happiest Halloween thoughts tend to be like seasonal. I love fall. Mm-hmm. I love, you know, cider, things like that. But I don't really associate Halloween with anything particularly scary. Well, so what I would like to suggest is that if you are out there and you have a costume or you have a Halloween story or you want to contradict me and Glenn about cider, which I don't think you will, but if you do, come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH and leave us a note, or come to the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And that is Halloween.
Do feel free to contradict Stephen on that candy corn.
That's true.
I can't contradict that.
You know what? I can't help my taste in candy.
Segue.
I have the taste that I have, and I can't unlearn it.
Well, you'll all be glad to know that we are continuing to take ideas from listeners who are, in many cases, smarter than we are.
Uh-huh.
And Caleb Keller, thank you very much, Caleb Keller. That's a great name, by the way. It should be the protagonist of a Hallmark movie. I'm just saying, because that's all I do anymore. But suggested the topic of good taste, specifically whether or not we believe there is such a thing as good taste in culture. How do you get it? I suppose, how do you know if you have it? Stephen, thoughts?
Well, you know,
You're a man of good taste.
But I'm also somebody who often goes on this incredibly tiresome spiel about guilty pleasures and how liking things that are not respected by the right people is somehow something to be ashamed of. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on one hand, I sort of immediately go to a place of good taste is whatever you can passionately defend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in general, when I was thinking about that idea, good taste is what you can passionately defend. What that means is that that sort of gives your opinions the added authenticity of belief, mm-hmm. that you're not simply going along with a crowd. You know, and I think the fear with adhering to what is viewed as good taste is that you're going along with the crowd.
Right, yeah. Right. What do you think about good taste, Glenn?
Well, I mean, it's exactly what you said, Stephen. What is popularly considered good taste is what is popularly considered. Mm-hmm. It feels like something that is pressed upon you by society, by here's what we have all assigned is good taste. To me, it's more about exactly what you said, discernment, the ability to single out why something works or does not work for you and being able to articulate it.
Right.
There's an element of culling, I think. There's an element of being able to kind of go through these things. But what it isn't is reflexive. What it isn't is automatic. I went through my 20s reflexively overpraising every art house film I saw mm-hmm. and reflexively dismissing every big budget action figure.
Right.
I can remember sitting there while people were trying to tell me about The Fugitive, and I can remember rolling my eyes and going, oh, well, I'm sure you like it. It's not
for me.
Those
are what art men.
I know. And of course, it's a great film. And I was really doing myself a huge disservice because I had bought into this notion of good taste without uh-huh. making it personal.
Right.
How about you, Tanya?
As you know, I have a full, healthy diet of trash television.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Me too.
Also me.
And I couldn't possibly defend why I watch Love and Hip Hop Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. There's very no popular show.
It's trash.
Yeah.
I can't begin to tell you why, but it's not because other people like it, because I like Downton Abbey, and that's not because other people like it. But I do think that sometimes we can sort of wallow in the trash.
Yeah.
To the point where the bar is so low that you can't even recognize
yeah.
that your bar has sunk so low.
So do you think, do you sort of feel like when you watch Love and Hip Hop Atlanta, you distinguish between my taste in terms of what I enjoy watching versus my taste in what I think is good?
Right.
Yes.
Because it kind of sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yes, yes.
Like the fact that, and that's one of the things that frustrates me sometimes is that people, if you take in a certain kind of culture, people assume that you're doing it without knowing the difference
right.
between that and something right. else. Like for whatever reason, it is absolutely true that for whatever reason, I've been watching a bunch of Hallmark movies over the last couple weeks. I really don't completely know why this is. It's just one of those things that comes and goes, like wanting to watch cooking shows. And it's not like I don't know the difference
right.
between that and something that's more creatively elevated. But it's just sometimes it's what I'm in the mood for. You know what I mean?
Well, and it's like that with food, isn't it? I mean, we all like a certain amount of empty calories and treats uh-huh. and whatever. I mean, I watch, as has been discussed on the show, I watch pretty much every Bachelor franchise.
You do.
At no point.
People don't like it when you talk about
it. I know. And at no point am I sitting there saying, this is awesome.
Right.
It's just, it's silly.
Or that it's awesome in the same way as, you know, like Breaking Bad is awesome.
Right, exactly. It's not in any, really by any measure, a good show. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, you know, the fact that I'll eat, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning, eat Crunch Berries.
Yeah.
It's just comfort food in some certain goofy way that I think is entirely separate from taste.
So when you talk about taste, it almost sounds like what we're saying is that what Glenn was saying with discernment is like that having good taste is more meaningful to us anyway. In terms of understanding the difference between the pleasures provided by different kinds of things, as opposed to liking the right list of things.
There are certain areas where you can't simply dismiss as bad taste entire genres
sure.
of things. And I think, you know, if you look at music criticism, for example, I think at this point, virtually any respected or respectable music critic is going to have some knowledge and understanding and appreciation of pop music,
mm-hmm.
unless it's obviously I'm not counting jazz critics and classical mm-hmm. critics, but somebody whose job is to digest and have opinions
sure.
about popular music
sure.
is going to understand that the last Rihanna record is really good or the mm-hmm. last whatever incredibly, incredibly popular thing. I think that a lot of simple snobbery has dissipated somewhat in certain critical circles.
I think that's probably true. The thing that was interesting to me when I started to think about this, I think about this almost like I do religion, believe it or not. Because whatever you believe about religion, the one thing that I am most certain of is that I know no human being infallible enough to tell anyone else what the answer is.
Right.
So it's like whatever you believe about it, I think you have to get it from somewhere other than having someone else tell it to you. So my issue with people who, you know, talk a lot about you don't have good taste is important, like, I believe good taste is important. I believe good taste exists. I believe there's such a thing as having good taste. But I don't know anyone who is so smart that I would trust them to dictate to other people what good taste is. It's almost like it's such a big question that I'm much more convinced that no one person can answer it, yeah. can answer that question than I am of what the answer is.
And so, I'm that one person.
And so it becomes, I mean, with, you know, talking about criticism and talking about the job of the color, and you know, everybody at this table is a color of one sort or another.
Sure.
Is you simply,
it's true.
You know, our job is sort of just to take in as much as possible. And when we love something, get excited about it and mm-hmm. tell people.
Yeah. I mean, the premise that people seem to have bought into is that taste is subjective, but good taste isn't. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Let's talk about bad taste a little bit. John Waters, who has made himself a paragon of bad taste, prides himself upon
this
bad
is a
taste.
Different yes. kind of
totally,
taste. Yeah.
It is a totally different thing. It's not just doing filthy things for the sake of doing filthy things, although that's maybe about 60% of what he's doing. He's also reacting against something. And as society kind of loosened up, his films became less...
Transgressive
and more conventional. And I think, you know, I just reviewed a book by Robert and Eileen Crum called Drawn Together. Their mission statement is that any detail of our lives is great if it's uncomfortable, if it's true, if it's abject, you know, misery. That's true. That's what I want to see. And what they, in my opinion, what they fail to also realize is that it's not just making a revelation about yourself. It has to, whatever you say about yourself has to go someplace. It can't just simply transgress for the sake of transgressing. That's not interesting. You're not giving me anything that I couldn't get myself.
Unless you're offering some sort of universal look. I mean, if it's just specific to them, unless they are the most fascinating people in the world, who cares?
Right.
There's a difference between taste in the sense of you have good taste in books versus taste in the sense of that is tasteful or not tasteful. Like, that is in bad taste. Like, there are many things that are in bad taste almost empirically that I think are almost empirically good. Like you said, some of the John Waters stuff and certain things like that that people consider to be in poor taste but that I would consider to be artful.
Right.
Artful but in poor taste. That's a very tricky distinction.
Plenty of music in that category too.
A lot of comics.
Say many good comics. I won't say most because I do love a lot of clean comedy too, but most of your major comics are at least arguably in bad taste.
But what I'm objecting to, I guess, is this notion that just because I said something transgressive, I'm speaking the truth and you can't react to it.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, gosh, absolutely.
There has been recently with, you know, a lot of comics are coming in for, with sites like Splitsider, they're coming in for more criticism. Mm-hmm. Like criticism as in like any piece of art is criticized. They get reviewed. And they really object to that notion because they see that the only metric that's meaningful to me is, do I make you laugh? Mm-hmm. And if I make you laugh, then I'm doing my job. They seem to want to excerpt themselves from what every other artist is doing. Mm-hmm. They seem to want to excerpt themselves from having to answer criticism or at least acknowledge criticism. It's not about whether or not somebody's right or not. It's about, okay, well, you've said this, it causes this reaction, and you own that. You own the fact that it causes
that
reaction.
Well, and when you talk about things that, if I try to imagine people I think of as having bad taste in a certain kind of culture, I come up with two things, one of which is something that you guys have already talked about, which is that I don't think it's a very genuine taste.
Right.
I don't think it's a taste that comes from a real place. I think it's a something that comes from kind of trying to look like a certain kind of person. The other kind of taste, interestingly enough, is what I would refer to as angry taste, people whose taste to me comes off like, I like this kind of music because it really sticks it to this kind of person. I like this kind of TV show because it really skewers that kind of person.
Right. Or I hate this kind of music because hipsters like that.
Your taste is coming from anger. It's like, I mean, I'm sure she took it from someone, but I think it was Oprah I heard one time say that there's only two real emotions, love and fear. Mm. And that if your taste is coming from fear instead of love, then I think you wind up with what I would consider bad taste. So what I would encourage you to do is if you have good taste or you think you have good taste, you know, we're always interested in conversations about taste. And so come find us on Facebook or the blog and talk to us about that because, you know, we're always interested in these things. Right, Stephen?
We really, really are. Please like us on Facebook. It's really all we have.
It's true. You have good taste in podcasts. That's why you're here right now. All right. That brings us to our final segment, which is what is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I have a certain group of friends who are always trying to push new animated shows on me. And, you know, they have steered me right in the past, but they've steered me incredibly wrong in the past. These are the folks who tried to turn me on to Squidbillies, a show that, you know, it might be very good. It's just not. Let's talk about taste. It's not for Glenn's.
Yeah.
At least it's not for Glenn's who aren't very, very high.
Yeah.
Metapocalypse, same thing. It's just not for me. So this show has been around for 4 years, the one they just turned me on to, or have been trying to turn me on to. And, you know, I've been aware of its work. I've acknowledged it. But I'm thinking, you know, someday I'll be flipping around on the channels and I'll find it and I'll linger over it and I'll see it. But here's the thing. You don't flip around
yeah,
anymore.
That's true. Right. You got to go to some trouble. Yeah,
yeah, you can only assign your DVR, or you can have things on demand. I just don't flip around the channels anymore. So
you can still flip channels.
But one doesn't.
One named Glenn.
One named Glenn. This show is called Adventure Time.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I've seen snips of the show before.
Glenn's like, don't give me your
I think that's what was making me happy like a year ago.
When I saw it before, it's like, okay, well, this is a thing I'll spend some more time on, you know, at some future time. But this weekend when I had three book reviews I had to write, I said, I'll pop in one little episode there. Every episode contains two 15-minute things. And 6 hours later, this show is so good. The sensibility of the show is a very deadpan. It's set in this sort of fantasy world. It has an incredibly rich and strange and dark cosmology, I guess you'd call it, that kind of reveals itself to the viewer slowly over the course of many episodes. These relationships between these characters don't stay static. They change. People have layers and depth. And the animation is what really, you know, struck me as kind of grotesque the first time I saw it. But there is behind the show a real vision. There is something very singular, very unique about this show that you're not going to find anywhere else. And so when you watch the show, you feel that vision. You feel like you're in good hands. So I highly recommend this very funny, very strange show.
Yeah, and my kids love that show.
Well, that's a good sign.
And there are a couple of DVD compilations of it, and I highly, highly recommend it. It's
wonderful.
A really fun show.
All right, Stephen, what is making you happy this week?
Well, if we had some sort of rule about being excited about things our friends do, this would violate it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have in my clammy hands a new book. It is called Weird Al the Book, and I am biased several times over.
You are. This is hopeless.
This is some cold bias, because Weird Al is a pal, and the person who wrote the book is our pal Nathan Rabin, who is the head writer of the AV Club, the author of a couple of terrific books like The Big Rewind and My Year of Flops. And it is
who hasn't been mentioned on the show in at least a month.
And it's been like, it's probably been like 2 or 3 months since we've mentioned Nathan.
It's true.
But it's a sort of coffee table book. It is, you know, hardbound, packed with silly pictures. I just got it in the mail like half an hour before taping, but I'm very excited about it. I've been hugely looking forward to it, and it is called Weird Al the Book, available at fine booksellers near you.
I believe it was Seth Green who tweeted about that book. Best book of all time. Sorry, the Bible. Which I thought was fairly amusing. All right, Tanya Ballard Brown, what is making you happy this week?
You know, today I had a coworker say they saw something and they thought of me. They wondered who would really appreciate this.
That's always flattering.
Right. And you know what it was? It was Macklemore and Ryan Lewis thrift shop featuring Wands or Wands.
I had a broken keyboard. I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket. Then I bought a kneeboard. Hello, my ace man, my mellow. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game. Hello. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads would be like,
he got the Velcro. Whoa.
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket.
This is a great video where this dude has on this big pimp fur coat, and then there's a DeLorean, and some folks are riding a bicycle, and then they're in a club, and he's like, I got $20 and I'm going to the thrift store. What you buying a watch for $50? You know what I can get for $50 at that thrift store? It's not safe for work, people. Language. But it entertained me for a good 10 or 15 minutes because I watched it 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
I did.
And did you feel ultimately that the person who felt that it was perfect to entertain you was correct, spot on?
They knew. Spot this person on. Was fingers to eyes, okay?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Fingers to
We're
eyes.
We're doing mind meld right now.
They knew. Tanya. That was all me.
That's fantastic. We will perhaps help people find it, but perhaps not show it to them since it's
not safe for work. Language.
Language. All right. Trey Graham picked Nashville, and unfortunately, he's not here to enjoy this. But what is making me happy this week is that I had seen the Nashville pilot, which was really quite good. Mm-hmm. And then there was a long run-up. It debuted fairly late after most everything else had already come on. So I missed the pilot, and then I missed the second one. And I had to go back and catch up. But this week, I went back, and I watched the pilot again, and I watched the second episode of Nashville, and it is so good.
Really?
It is so good.
It is.
And it's making me nuts because it's not doing very well, and it's absolutely making me nuts. When the show gets canceled, I'm going to be so sad and depressed. And
but you'll be able to rub it in Trey's face that he picked the wrong show.
Also that.
Why do you think people don't like it? I mean, I lived in Nashville for 2 years, so when I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, there's the, oh, the,
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know that it's that people don't like it. It's just that enough of them aren't watching it.
The thing that gets me about it, and the thing that I was engaging in some Twitter-based appreciation of it with some other people today, we talked at the time, I think we talked about this show the first time, that Callie Corey, who created this show, is married to T-Bone Burnett. Mm-hmm. And so T-Bone Burnett has been overseeing all the music, which is a very good sign.
Yes.
And this is the incredibly rare TV show or movie about music that has invested adequately in the music so that you believe.
Or any art form. I mean, when
right,
you think
exactly.
about how many shows are about art that
right.
don't do the art well.
Other than stuff like That Thing You Do is a great
right.
song.
Yeah.
There are scattered examples, but other than that, historically very bad. When you see a big song, it's like, well, this would never be a big song. On this show, they are using real music. And, you know, the downside is, you know, not all of it is like for the show. Some of it is existing music. A lot of it is actually existing songs that have already been recorded, but in many cases generally are not like hugely famous. And so both the first episode and the second episode end with these really gorgeous duets that I absolutely loved. And it turned out, after I went and investigated them, this is where Stephen's going to get his gloat on anyway. They're both Civil War songs.
Oh, sure.
One of them, I believe, is on an actual studio record of theirs. And one of them, somebody just told me today on Twitter, is on a live performance of theirs that I have to now go look up. This show is like, you can actually watch the show and then you can actually listen to the music. And the next day you'll be like, I want to hear that song again. You go back and listen to the song. That never happens. That's why I didn't like Smash.
Is Hayden Panettiere singing? Is that
her
singing?
They're both singing. They're all actually singing. Hayden Panettiere and Connie Britton and Charles Estes, who used to be Chip Estes when he was on Whose Line.
Yeah.
But now he's Charles. Now he calls himself Charles.
Is that the Deacon character?
Yes.
Okay.
He was
the
lone hot one on Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Absolutely. And now he goes by Charles and he's a dramatic actor. Mm-hmm. But that show is actually good enough that you would listen to the music on purpose,
mm-hmm. right.
which is really, really rare. So I just want to give humongous props to them. I actually have gone back and listened to some of those songs several times. And
the music is really great. It is.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow Tanya at TBB. That's TBB. Spelled out, you know, not just the T and the B's. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are still tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.